Hi, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Quick note on programming here. Candidates who want to be Wisconsin's next governor are set to debate tonight, and you can hear it live on WPR. The Wisconsin Broadcasters Association debate starts at 7. Listen to an hour of debate and then analysis after it wraps here on WPR and at WPR.org. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The midterm elections around the corner. We tackle a variety of questions about the midterms from a class of Wisconsin eighth graders. But first, here's producer Mary Kate McCoy with a Wisconsin Life story about an animal sanctuary.
Primate research has led to countless scientific breakthroughs. But when a monkey is no longer needed for research, what happens next can be an ethical quandary. In South Central Wisconsin, a team runs a sanctuary for monkeys as a way to say thank you for their contributions to science. Jana Rose Slice brings us the story.
There's a small animal sanctuary tucked away in a quiet rural area in Marquette County. Here, you'll find 9 monkeys living in habitats close to their natural environment.
That's actually Bella doing a warning call, saying stranger danger, there's visitors today. But she likes to let the other monkeys know what's going on.
That's Amy Kerwin, executive director and founder of Primates, Inc.
And then Jojo on the right, he's a green monkey. He's just 1 year old.
The monkeys living here were former research animals or pets. Kerwin used to work with 97 rhesus monkeys in a University of Wisconsin-Madison lab. She loved caring for them as they were used for biomedical research.
You know, some labs don't want your employees to grow close to the animals, but since the monkeys are so like us, it's almost inevitable. You're going to grow close to them, so why not help facilitate and give a chance so they can give back?
Kerwin has set out to do just that. When an animal is no longer needed for research, it has few options. It costs thousands of dollars for one monkey's retirement care.
It costs just hundreds of dollars to be able to euthanize a monkey to free up their cage or sell them to more research than you actually make money. So the motivation to retire is an ethical compromise.
After learning about the barriers monkeys face getting into retirement, especially in Wisconsin, Kerwin decided to make a change. She started Primates, Inc. so the retired monkeys can live their lives as close to their wild counterparts as possible. It's also a way to thank them for their contributions to science. Fallon Mullen also used to work with monkeys in a research lab and is now the animal care manager at Primates, Inc. She's responsible for the day-to-day care of the monkeys.
This is Mars, just turned 16, like I said. He is a rhesus macaque male as well, also from the biomedical industry, and he's paired with Timon, who everyone calls Sweet Timon because she's just so kind of timid and really, really sweet-natured.
Many of Primates, Inc. residents have never lived in their natural environment. Staff maintain greenhouses, raised walkways, and indoor and outdoor spaces for the monkeys. Mullen says this encourages natural behaviors like foraging, grooming, and playing.
But we've never seen a monkey actually swim. They'll sit in the pool. The pools are, you know, like either like kiddie pools that you would imagine or like turtle sandbox, you know, about that depth. So not real deep. But the monkeys in the past have, you know, like I said, just sat in them, waited in them.
But Mullen says that changed when a pair of surrendered pets showed up.
But Noah, who is a rhesus macaque male, he is paired with Maddie. We just gave them their pool this month. And he can be seen actually swimming. So he goes under the water and does several circles and will come up for air. And it's just so amazing to see because he didn't learn this from the other monkeys here. So this was just like his natural instinct coming out. And also such a great story about why monkeys should have the opportunity for retirement. It's just so amazing.
Kerwin hopes to grow Primates, Inc. to house 100 monkeys because she sees the impact retirement in a natural environment can have on former research animals.
Jana Roche Leis brought us that story about an animal sanctuary. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Mary Kate McCoy.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we hear what's on the minds of eighth graders in the Milwaukee area in the lead up to November's general election. Students especially, join in with your questions about the midterms, what you've seen or heard by the campaigns, what you and your friends wonder. The call-in number is 800-642-1234, or you can email ideas at WPR.org. Sean Johnson is fielding questions from middle schoolers. He's Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, Kate. Thanks for having me.
So these eighth graders in the Fox Point Bayside School District, they want to pick your brain. I hope you've had your Wheaties.
Oh, man. I'm so nervous about it, too, because kids ask, like, you know, I have a seventh grader.
Yeah. We've got middle schoolers in the house.
and they have a tendency to ask questions that I think I know. And then I realized, oh, actually, I need to do more research for that. So that was the case for some of these questions.
All right. Well, buckle up. Here we go. So two students want to know what the election could mean for the balance of power in Congress. Let's hear from Anna and then Henry right after that.
My name is Anna, and my question is, how will the midterms affect who has more pull in the Senate? The Republicans versus the Democrats?
Hello there. My name is Henry. I'm from Bayside Middle School. How will the midterms affect the sway of power in Congress? Thank you for your time.
Okay, so what could the results mean for Congress?
That is very much up in the air right now because Congress is so closely divided, and especially in the Senate. I mean, just to get a load of these numbers, there's 50 Republicans, mm-hmm. but there are 48 Democrats, but two independents caucus with the Democrats. So then you have basically a 50-50 Senate, and you have a Democratic vice president, Kamala Harris. She is the tie-breaking vote. And so Democrats are the majority party in the U.S. Senate. They set the agenda. And it's kind of created an atmosphere where any one Democratic lawmaker can derail legislation. They can demand changes. So you have, you know, certain Democrats like West Virginia Democratic U.S. Senator Joe Manchin, Arizona Democratic Senator Kyrsten Sinema, they have a lot of sway in the Senate because they're in, you know, extremely competitive districts. And sometimes they'll say to the Democratic Party, hey, I want you to change stuff for me. So what could happen in the Senate? I mean, if you tip that 50-50 balance, then Republicans could control it. Democrats are looking to pick up a couple more seats so that they don't have to kind of cater to those legislators who have so much power right now. But it's close. We'll say that it's very close in Congress, in the U.S. House. Mm-hmm. You have similarly close 220 Democrats, 212 Republicans, three vacancies. I think there's a pretty plausible case that given the kind of election we're in, Republicans could pick up a majority in the U.S. House. And, you know, that's partly because of, you know, the way that districts have changed over the last 10 years, the way that they were redrawn in redistricting, mm-hmm. which happens every 10 years, and just the kind of election that we're in right now. And you could see this play out in Wisconsin right now. We have five Republicans and three Democratic members of Congress. That could be potentially, depending on how this plays out, it could be 6-2. Both chambers are very close. And what's it mean? If you have Republicans in control of one or both chambers of, you know, either the Senate or the U.S. House, President Biden is not going to be able to do much. You know, it's going to be very hard for him to advance his agenda. It's going to be very hard for Republicans to advance theirs. And you will have probably gridlock in the federal government in Washington.
Well, let's look at state government. And we saw the Marquette University Law School poll released this week showing really neck and neck Democratic Governor Tony Evers and the construction executive Republican challenger Tim Michaels. How often are statewide races typically that close in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin, statewide races are just so frequently so close. I mean, you look at the last two races for president. In 2016, former Republican President Donald Trump won by less than a percentage point. In 2020, Democratic President Joe Biden won by less than a percentage point. In 2018, Democratic Governor Tony Evers won by just a little bit more than a percentage point. You know, you can go on down to like races for state Supreme Court that have been decided by, and a statewide race have been decided by like 5,000 votes. We're extremely, extremely close and very important to national politics at large, but certainly in state government, it's anyone's guess how this will turn out in the governor's race.
Governor Evers has, as you mentioned there, highlighted his status as like the only barrier to total Republican control. And I wonder if you could just give us a bit more context. What would a Michaels victory mean for Wisconsin's Republican-controlled legislature?
Yeah, in Wisconsin state government, it is a different story than in the federal government. Mm-hmm. We have in Wisconsin, while we are a very closely divided state in terms of the number of Democratic voters and the number of Republican voters, our state legislature is very Republican. And that is partly because of the way that Democratic voters are so concentrated in Madison and Milwaukee and other cities. So they're not spread out among all of these 99 assembly districts and 33 Senate districts. It's also partly because Republicans got to draw the map, that the political map that decided what these districts look like. And essentially they got to pick their voters. And so they have a very Republican map. These districts that they're running in are more Republican than, you know, the state at whole, mm-hmm. at large. So you're going to have probably a Republican legislature next year and in the state government. And so if Tony Evers is governor, he is going to veto a lot of their bills. He vetoed more bills this past legislative session than any governor in the history of Wisconsin going back to 1848. If Tim Michaels is governor, he is going to sign a lot of those bills. And so Republicans will set the agenda in Wisconsin for the next 4 years if Tim Michaels is governor.
Sean Johnson covers politics, WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief. He's responding to what middle schoolers want to know about the midterm elections. Join in on what you or your child has noticed this election season, what your conversations have been like around elections. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson fielding questions from eighth graders in the Fox Point Bayside School District. Sean is providing analysis and context to what the middle schoolers see unfolding in the lead up to the November midterms. Join in along the way on elections, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sean, several students submitted questions wondering how the sky-high inflation could affect the midterms. And here's Reese seeking more details on the differences between the political parties.
Who do voters blame for inflation, and what is each party's plan for plan to action?
Okay, so Marquette polling shows inflation a big, big concern among voters. How are Democrats and Republicans talking about inflation?
Yeah, they are. I mean, there's a lot of blaming going around when it comes to how they talk about it. You know, as to Reese's question, I was just looking for polling on this. Marquette hasn't asked people, like, who do you blame for inflation? The Marquette University Law School poll that we, you know, look at so frequently here in Wisconsin. The Associated Press did recently, and you had a majority of people said that higher than usual prices are mostly because of factors outside of President Biden's control, while 44% blamed President Joe Biden. I think whenever you're talking about an election, there is this sort of old adage in politics attributed to James Carville, who was, you know, ran President Clinton's campaign in 1992.
That is a blast from the past, that name.
Yeah. But I think it's, I just think it stands the test of time because it's so simple and it's kind of effective. And he said at the time, the country was in a recession and he was telling Clinton's campaign, you know, it's the economy, stupid, was his reminder to them. Like, no, all the other noise that happens in a campaign, he was saying it's the economy, stupid, you know, because whether or not it's the president's fault, the way that people feel when the economy is going through something is it affects their mood. It affects the way that they feel about everything. And so no president wants to be overseeing an economy that is in some way struggling. And so that is the political challenge that Democrats face right now, is that they are in control at a time when the country is facing inflation, you know, which is essentially your money is worth less now than it was a year ago. The cost of living is more expensive. They're overseeing this at for the first time in like 40 years. You know, as far as what the candidates are saying about it and what can be done. And I think you could easily do a couple hours, Kate, with actual economists who could tell you like what can be done. But I think the Federal Reserve, which is our nation's central bank, has the most power to address this. And it is independent from Congress and the president. It's extremely powerful. It sets interest rates. And what the Federal Reserve does about inflation matters a lot. But what the candidates are saying, you basically have Republicans blaming Democrats for spending too much. That's what Senator Ron Johnson said at last night's debate, that the government has spent too much, that they've caused this inflation. You have Democrats saying we need some kind of a targeted tax cut. So Lieutenant Governor Mandel Barnes, or Democrat running for U.S. Senate, has said a middle class tax cut is what we need. He wants to make permanent the child tax credit, which is, you know, what these students' parents got in 2021. There was expanded child tax credit, which was a monthly payment to parents. And Tony Evers, Wisconsin Governor Tony Evers, has called for using the state's projected budget surplus to basically cut a check to every Wisconsin resident for $150, and also have a temporary state gas tax holiday, meaning you wouldn't have to pay the gas tax for a little while.
Well, let's just pause right there with Jack in Madison with a question. Jack, go ahead.
Hi there.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Yeah, so I believe I just heard Sean talking about inflation and how that's one of the issues that Republicans, especially deficit hawk type figures, tend to really get fixated on. And I was watching the debate last night, and one of the things I was saying to myself was, how did we get to have so much debt? And obviously the Republicans like to say that it relates to all the spending that Dems like to do. But what I think is telling is the fact that a lot of it really comes from tax breaks and giveaways to billionaires and whatnot. And so I guess my question is, assuming Dems are able to hold down the fort in this election cycle, and again, is informed by common knowledge in poli-sci circles, that may be kind of a tall order, as the party in power tends to, well, you know how the cycle goes. But I wonder what the strategy could be for Dems in terms of, like, really getting the message across about debt, and then reducing debt, you know, with the understanding that a lot of it is related to tax giveaways more so than quote unquote unnecessary spending.
Sean, go ahead.
I think in terms of what Democrats can do to shape the federal deficit, I feel like this, you know, they have kind of had a couple years to address that. You saw some of that. They did pass a federal, the Democrats called it the Inflation Reduction Act, mm-hmm. which did, it is projected to reduce the federal budget deficit by about $300 billion over 10 years, in part by increasing taxes on corporations. But that is, I know that's a lot of money, and it's weird to say this, but that is kind of a small number when you're talking about a 10-year span and the federal deficit. So, I mean, I think the challenge for Democrats is when you're in power with such slim majorities, it has proven tough for them to take really broad strokes, I guess, when it comes to dealing with the way we spend money in the federal government. They have done it a few times, but you know, like stuff like Jack is talking about is politically challenging.
Sean Johnson, Capital Bureau Chief of WPR, stays with us as we talk about midterm elections, questions from eighth graders. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We get answers from Wisconsin, or for Wisconsin eighth graders, rather, who have questions about the November general election. Students wanting to explore what's at stake in November's vote and key issues voters will consider here in Wisconsin. You can join in along the way. Add your student's question in the mix, 800-642-1234. Sean Johnson covers politics as WPR's Capital Bureau Chief and is our guide. Sean, Jack and Jacob, they are curious about the effectiveness of political ads and campaign spending. So let's hear from Jack and then Jacob.
Hi, I'm Jack. I'm from Bayside, and this is my question. Does advertising / money spending affect how well a candidate does?
Hello, I am Jacob, and I have a handful of questions. My first one is, how do politicians decide how to target political ads, and are they effective? My second is, what are issues that will be most important in swaying voters in the upcoming elections?
So we'll zero in on the political ad piece there. The Wisconsin Democracy Project tracks campaign spending. As you know, in the governor's race alone, these advocacy groups have reported spending more than $17 million since the August primary elections. How much do political ads influence public opinion, Sean?
I think that anybody who'd ever worked on a political campaign or candidates who have won them would tell you ads matter, you know, and not as me, almost as much as anything, I guess. It's hard to overstate the significance of the ability of a candidate to spend money or to have money spent on their behalf and run these ads and like blanket the TV airwaves of Wisconsin or the social media feeds of Wisconsin with advertising for their campaigns. And you kind of see this play out in different ways. I mean, in a close state like Wisconsin, people who have money or who want to spend money on politics tend to want to spend it here because our races are so competitive. They matter so much in terms of, you know, what happens in state government, in the federal government. And so donors spend money on our candidates, and that tells you that they think it matters. And then I think once you see a race, you can sometimes see more money start to flow to candidates who seem like they have a better chance of winning. So again, that's sort of these donors saying, we're going to bet on you, you know? And yeah, I can't say, I guess I can't overstate really how much advertising and money matters in politics.
And these middle schoolers might be seeing political ads while streaming videos or YouTube, browsing on social media. I know mine are. How do you suggest they consider whether that information is trustworthy? What do you tell them when they see these ads?
It's a little jarring, isn't it, Kate? I mean, yes. You'll be watching like family TV at night and people just kind of hanging out, relaxed. And then one of these ads comes on and the tone is so dark and it changes everything. And sometimes my kids look at me like, what?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mine will say, Mom, that scares me. What's going on?
Yeah, seriously, mm-hmm. seriously. And these ads are meant to do that. They are meant to get your attention. And in some cases, they are meant to frighten voters a little bit, you know, depending on the issue. I would say that you should always be at least a little skeptical of the ads that you see. That's not to say that they are lying. There are many nuggets of truth in these ads. There are also many exaggerations and sometimes lies in these ads. And so just don't accept what you see without giving it a little thought. These ads can highlight issues that are important to voters and using facts, you know, they can be beneficial to the campaign. They can inform voters, but just don't accept what they say without giving a little thought, a little research. And how do you do that? You can check out stories on WPR, you know, WPR.org, you know, other sources like the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Associated Press, Wisconsin State Journal, Cap Times in Wisconsin, you know, places that write about these and look into the factual claims and provide context. So that I guess that's my advice.
We haven't talked about the issue of abortion yet, but that really continues to be a focal point of the midterms following the fall of Roe in June. And, you know, fact checkers have put up some red flags, like these ads have been misleading or made false claims about the candidate's statements on abortion. So what role do you see abortion having in these campaign ads, and what should we be mindful of when we see them?
I think that, you know, the abortion issue in this campaign is kind of the wild card in this campaign season, because normally when one party controls Congress, you know, and which Democrats currently can control the U.S. Senate and the House and the presidency, the midterm election for that party ends up being pretty rough, because our country tends to ping back and forth between Republican and Democrat. They don't want to give one party too much control for too long, it would seem. And we've experienced that a lot lately. But historically in the United States, in the last century, when one party's in control for a cycle, it tends to swing back. And so that's the situation that we would normally be in this election. We may be in this election with this being a potentially good election for Republicans. But the U.S. Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade, a decision which had been the law of the land in this country for 50 years, has changed things, because that issue matters a lot to a segment of voters, and it has motivated them to vote. I mean, abortion policy is the top issue for Democratic voters in the most recent survey by Marquette University. And so it matters in that they could be more motivated to get out turnout for Democrats than they might otherwise be in an election cycle like this one. As far as what to watch for in these ads, I guess the advice would be the same. You know, if there's a claim that is troubling or just perplexing to you, you know, check it out. In some cases, they're true, but there's a lot of information out there, and sometimes these ads will have a source for where they got the information from, but also be wary of the sources. You know, it's kind of easy to make stuff look like official when it's not that official.
Sean Johnson with us as we talk about the midterm elections and questions submitted by Wisconsin middle schoolers. Sean brings context and insight as WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. You can join in on your questions about the midterms, 800-642-1234. So, Sean, we're going to step into a noisy classroom where Serena is raising a question about the influence of different generations in the outcomes of elections.
I'm Serena, and my question was, how will the different generations of voters impact the midterm elections based on how their age groups and generations view and support the different current events?
Okay, so different age groups. So what are typical differences in voting patterns among the different generations?
Typically, I would say to Serena, it's going to be maybe her parents, maybe her grandparents, who are going to vote more in a given election. They represent a large block of voters in any given election. So, for example, in 2018, this was the last midterm election, so it's similar to what we're going through right now. 18 to 29-year-olds were about 36. They had turnout of about 36%, meaning out of the eligible 18 to 29-year-olds, you know, a little more than one out of three of them voted. Out of eligible 30 to 44-year-olds, almost half of them voted. Out of eligible 45 to 64-year-olds, 60%, six out of 10 of them voted. And when you get up over 65, voters who are 65 or older, two out of three of them voted, 66%. So the older you get, the more apt you are to vote. And so campaigns, candidates pay attention to those voters. I will say that, like, in 2018, voter turnout was up for a midterm, and it was up for younger voters. And in 2020, turnout was up, way up for younger voters compared to what we usually see. About half of them voted. I think, though, typically you see a lower turnout in a midterm.
And I saw this statistic that more than 8 million youth are now newly eligible to vote in the midterm. So, and, you know, I don't know, 8.3 million newly eligible young voters, what impact that would have. But that is also something to pay attention to, these newly minted voters who have turned 18 since the 2020 election.
Absolutely. And also, you know, our country's politics have been shaped by, you know, we refer to them as the baby boomer generation for decades now. They've been the most powerful force in politics. And we're seeing, you know, that start to change through the natural course of life. And so we don't necessarily know exactly what that means.
Sean Johnson is Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. He's fielding questions about November's midterm elections. What are the issues? What's at stake? How the process works at the local level? Still time to join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A special thank you to the Fox Point Bayside School District for collaborating with us on questions about the midterm elections. And also thank you to PBS Wisconsin Education for connecting us with curious educators and students. We appreciate all your effort to elevate student voices as we continue to probe this question. What are the issues eighth graders want to bring up about November's vote? Let's dig in more. We have expertise from WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Sean, Juliana wants to know more about the process that allows candidates to get on ballots.
My question about the midterm election is, how does one qualify to be a part of the midterm elections?
Okay, so how do candidates get on the ballot, Sean?
The short answer is you just have to get signatures from a bunch of people to get on the ballot in Wisconsin. You got to get signatures from other adults in Wisconsin. So to run for U.S. Senate, you need to be 30 years old. U.S. House, 25. You have to be to run for governor or their state offices. You have to be 18. And then to get on the ballot for the United States Senate, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, treasurer, secretary of state, Wisconsin Supreme Court, you need 2,000 valid signatures on a nominating petition that you or someone else circulated on your behalf saying, I want to get this person on the ballot. To get on the ballot for the U.S. House, it's 1,000 signatures. For state senator, it's 400 signatures. For state assembly, so your state representative in Madison, you know, one of 99 people in the state assembly, they have to get 200 signatures. So very, very approachable in terms of getting on the ballot. Now, winning elections, that's, you know, that could be a different story. But the barriers to entry for getting on the ballot in Wisconsin are pretty relatively low.
Where do candidates typically collect those signatures? How do they do that?
You will sometimes see, so I mean, I can tell you, like in Madison, we if you go to the farmer's market here, you certainly see people out there circulating petitions, just asking people walking by if they'd like to sign. Parking lots, you know, that people could go to door and ask for signatures. Any number of ways that you could do it. There's, you know, it's up to the where the campaigns think they want to, they're going to get a bunch of people at once. You know, could be some kind of a town gathering, a fair, you name it. It's up to them.
Once they have those signatures, they have to do a lot of fundraising. I want to circle back a little bit to the money, Sean, because Quinn wants to know, how do candidates get the money for campaigning?
That is a great question, and it has become more and more complicated over the years. So in Wisconsin, there are contribution limits for different offices. There's that is to say, like, a donor can only give so much to candidates for different offices. So a donor could give somebody who's running for governor up to $20,000, or for state senate up to $2,000, state assembly up to $1,000. If you look at federal offices like U.S. Senate and House, I think it's $2,900 per election. Mm-hmm. But, and this is kind of a big caveat here, people can make, in Wisconsin, unlimited contributions to the state political parties. And the state parties can make unlimited contributions to the candidates, basically, transfers to the candidates. So if I'm a billionaire and I want to, you know, contribute a few million dollars to the Democratic Party Wisconsin or the Republican Party Wisconsin, I can do that. And candidates do. And actually, that's been like an effective fundraising tool for the Wisconsin Democratic Party for the last few cycles. You also have outside groups. Like in the Senate race, one of the big players for Republicans has been Wisconsin Truth PAC. It's a Republican super PAC, it's called. And its funders are almost exclusively Diane Hendricks and Richard and Elizabeth Uline, prominent billionaire Republican donors who are Diane Hendricks is. Richard and Elizabeth Uline are from Illinois, but they have a business. But they spend big on elections around the country, and they're spending big on behalf of Ron Johnson in that race. So there are so many ways that money can flow to elections. In the state assembly, it often relies more on a candidate going out there and raising money and putting in work to have the resources they need to run their campaign. But even in the state assembly, if it's a really competitive district, outside money is going to flow in to the race because, you know, people know these races matter so much.
WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson answering questions and insights from covering politics, fielding questions from Wisconsin eighth graders. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Sean, turning to the debate tonight at 7, WPR broadcasting the only scheduled debate between Democratic Governor Tony Evers and Republican challenger Tim Michaels. What will you be monitoring for?
I guess you want to see, I want to see if there's any particular area that Tim Michaels or Tony Evers kind of comes back to time and time again, because candidates have a way of, during these debates, They get asked a question about one topic, and then they sort of pivot and bring it around to the topic they want to talk about. So, you know, you could hear Tim Michaels, the Republican candidate for governor, get asked about, I don't know, any number of topics and pivot it around to talking about crime. That's been kind of his big issue against Tony Evers, is he's arguing that Tony Evers has not been tough on crime, has been soft on crime. I mean, Evers disputes that. Tony Evers may find a way to take a question about any number of issues and turn it around into a question about abortion and abortion laws, and highlight Tim Michaels' long opposition to abortion, you know, in Wisconsin. So I would look for that. I would look for attacks too, but I don't know that these two candidates in this particular format are going to attack all that much.
Yeah. I mean, how much do these debates, these debate performances matter?
They certainly, if you want to measure them up compared to like all these ads that we've been talking about and the money that is spent on those ads, they don't matter much. Although something that gets said in a debate could become fodder, you know, it could get used in one of those ads. If a candidate performs very well, it could look good in an ad for them. But sort of the danger for these candidates, and the reason you only, maybe the reason you only have one of these debates this year for governor, which is really low and it's unfortunate, is that there's a risk to these candidates for doing these things. Because if they say something that makes them look bad, or they come across poorly in this debate, it can turn into a 30-second, you know, TV ad overnight, and they pay the price.
Hmm. We only have a few seconds left, but what questions do you often get about being a politics reporter?
Oh, I feel like lately it's like, oh man, politics, like, whoa. I think a lot of people want to know, like, how do you sort of, I guess,
detox?
That's a question that other reporters ask. Like, no, it's like we're such a polarized country right now, and everything feels so political. And so, like, playing the role of traditional journalist, where you're supposed to kind of, you know, gather information and ideas from people from both parties, it's tricky. And so people want to know how you do that. And I just want to change the subject usually when somebody asks about politics. It's just, it is kind of tricky right now.
Sean, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, Kate. I appreciate it.
Sean Johnson is Capital Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. A big shout out and thank you to the Fox Point Bayside School District and PBS Wisconsin Education for your collaboration. And eighth graders, you have amazing questions. If you are a Wisconsin teacher and would like to partner on a segment featuring student questions, get in touch with us. Email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Morning Show production team includes Courtney Everett, Trevor Hook, Mackenzie Crummy, Joel Patnod, Royce Padeswa, and Joe Tarr. Our technical director is Maria Lopez. Keegan Kyle is interim executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stay with us next for 1A here on the Ideas Network.